Good morning and welcome. Are we all ready to make friends with death? Yay! Good. We're going to tweak the schedule today, and we're going to break for lunch at 12:30 and come back at 2, and that gives us a little more time in the morning before lunch makes us woozy. So that's the change. Also, after the teachings end this afternoon, at 4:30, we're going to have a Guru Puja, which anybody who wishes to is welcome to attend. It's a really lovely prayer service. We do it partially in Tibetan and partially in English. And so you're welcome to stay for that. I'll mention again that we'll have a workshop next month on the 10th of March, a Saturday, an all-day workshop on how to create your Dharma will, which is how to think about the practices that you think will be helpful to you at the time of your death and put together some instructions for that. Don't forget to silence your phones. I always hate that one. I want to try. Anyway, and then just a reminder that somebody over there, yeah, it's okay. It's not that disturbing. It's okay. Just a reminder that everything we do at Kadampa Center that is Dharma related, we offer at no charge. Anybody can come, and this is because these teachings are so precious and so helpful. I mean, what's more important than having some help so that we're not freaked out when we die?
I haven't felt this quite yet, though. I don't know if any of you know Denise and Christian. They're just brand new here, so they have two small boys. She's English, and they came with a good friend named Bronwyn with short red hair, so I don't know if you've met them yet. Chris just absolutely loved this place, and he died this morning of liver cancer, and they found it last week. So, yeah. Well, they both were. They all joined. They just joined here. I've known them for years. I taught her yoga for years, and Chris worked at Trader Joe's, and he's really one of the happiest men I think I've ever met. And he really, really felt strong about this place, and so I just wanted you guys to know and to pray for them.
Chris, what's his last name?
Kettner. K-E-T-T-N-E-R.
Oh, there we go. Is that on?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you. What's your name, Mr. Soundman?
Brian.
Brian? Yeah. Brian. Wonderful. Thank you so much. These are some of the most critical people are the sound people and the video people and the, you know, thank you. It's really, Chris and Brian. It's a lot of work. And, all the other people that, like Jill and Donna that made this happen and the drivers and the greeters and the man who wanted to make me tea this morning, very sweet, and many people. So thank you very much. And thank you also for coming, because what's just happened for Chris Kettner this morning is, and it's also helpful in a death course, that we lose people. And, you know, they didn't know a couple weeks ago that there was a problem. And now he's gone. And this happens all the time. So it's a matter of, again, as we said last night, of getting our minds together to just keep, we just keep working at it. We're not perfect. We just keep working on it, you know, and sometimes you get close and it gets very scary, and then it's great to have a center like this, because you can come and you can discuss it openly with people. There's exercises to do, which we will do today. We started last night. And it starts to bring you into this space of, this is scary. Why are we always scared? Why don't we want to talk about it? How can I think about it differently? And then slowly, this is a natural process. This is a natural part of life. You know, and there's this cyclical experience of life. And our minds, Tibetan Buddhism says, go on. So I'd like to make sure my mind goes on to a positive, pleasurable experience. How do I do that? You come here and you get instruction. It's all here. You got an amazing scholar, Geshe Gelug. You have some amazing teachers, and you can plug in online. There's all kinds of resources. And it's a process. So it's not going to happen in 2 weeks, that you're going to be all peaceful and wonderful. But it's a process. You can do it. You can do this. So for Chris Kettner, we will offer this for him today and think about him, and you can keep him in your prayers and things like that. So I'd just like to turn to the Gold Prayer Book, just more traditionally what we normally do before a teaching and before is we like to symbolically make an offering, and it's a little bit of a mirror of in ancient days, the Dharma was not given very freely. Okay? So people would save all their money and buy one precious jewel and show up at the teachings, or come with the jewel to beg the teacher to teach. You know, so as symbolic of that, we make a mandala offering. Mandala is the universe. We symbolize, just imagine the universe spreading out the finest things you can imagine. That's just things. Whether it's gold and jewels and precious food and flowers and, but I like to also offer, you know, all the beautiful scenery and sunsets I've ever seen and all the love I've ever experienced in my life and my precious family and friends. And the best thing to offer is your practice. So we sometimes put our hands like this, which is the symbol of the universe. Buddhists use, so the center is Mount Meru. And then there's four continents, 1, 2, 3, 4, like that you can try. But it's a symbol, like that. So we're going to turn to got it right here somewhere. There's a lot of prayers often that are done for traditionally, sometimes we'll be at a Buddhist teaching with the Dalai Lama, there'll be a half an hour of morning prayers. Like invoking the lineage lamas, like we could invoke the Lamrim lineage lamas to be here with us symbolically. It energizes. It makes this foundation for the teachings to happen like that. For us, we don't like that kind of stuff. We're like, let's get through the teaching, you know. But it is interesting how you come to setting a foundation, which also reminds me you need to set a foundation for your practice. So to get ready for death, you need to get the practice going. You need to set a foundation for that to happen. So we're going to talk a bit about that in the next couple of days. Bottom of page 97. The bottom of page 97 is the short mandala offering. It goes on to the next page. And let's just recite this in English with some sensibility, some feeling. And this is a little bit symbolic of the idea of the Buddhist universe. This ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. And then the line just below, Idam, you see that line that begins with Idam? Idam Guru Radna Mandala Kam Niratayami. And refuge and bodhicitta before the teaching. Okay, so these four lines, how many people here have taken refuge in Buddhism? Okay, do you recite this every day? That's your commitment once you take refuge. Three times in the morning, three times at night. Or have some sense of refuge. Okay, what is refuge? Just curious.
Shelter.
Shelter, right? Safe protection. Shelter. Thank you. Okay, so what are we trying to protect ourselves from? What do you want to protect yourself from? What do you need shelter from?
You've got it.
From yourself, right. And somehow you end up in the shelter with yourself, right, with your mind. Isn't that scary? Trying to protect ourselves from suffering, from more suffering. Okay? And suffering comes up in the mind in the nature of delusion, right? I mentioned last night anger, ignorance, attachment, jealousy, pride, fear, anxiety, depression. Those are delusions. There's many more of them. They molt into different shapes and forms. Not really shapes and forms, but you get the idea. So we would like to get protected from that think about for a moment, those of you not taking refuge in Buddhism or not clear about what it is and generally, honestly, what do you usually, you have a problem? What do you do when you have a problem? How does it go for you? I'm just curious. What do? You pray. Okay, great. Watch Netflix, right? Don't some of you watch Netflix? Don't some people eat when they have a problem? Go out for a run?
Google it.
You know? Google your problem? Yeah. You know? So none of these things, there's nothing wrong with any of these things. And they will, it's like putting a Band-Aid on. You know, like you get temporary relief with those things. But then the problem surfaces, the problem is there again. So what we do is we take refuge, as it says, the second line, the Buddha, the Dharma, Supreme Assembly. I know you're pretty familiar with this prayer, but some maybe not. So we take refuge in what's called, they are the three jewels of refuge, or the three Buddha, three gems, triple gem, take refuge in. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. The Buddha, historical Buddha that we know lived 2,600 years ago. The ultimate Buddha jewel is the omniscient mind. Wouldn't that be a cool thing to take refuge in? And the reason is, people come to you and they need help. You friends and family, you know, you have a problem. Wouldn't it be neat if you knew, capital K, what to do? How to respond? How to be? How to think? How to say? Every moment you live, you'd know. That's the Buddha mind. I would take refuge. I would seek support in that. For me, personally. That would work for me. The Dharma jewel is the philosophy on one level, our philosophy, and then all the Buddhist teachings, and it's also on an ultimate level, the teachings on emptiness, the nature of reality, that really removes the root of your suffering, emptiness. The Supreme Assembly is the Sangha. So it could be Sangha like me, monks and nuns. You have monks and nuns associated with this center, which is great. Arya, ultimate Sangha are the Arya Sangha, which means those that have had a direct perception of emptiness or the nature of reality. Because they can tell you how to cut out the root of the suffering, how to get there, how to work with your mind to see things directly, to see the true nature of things. So we would take refuge in that, what we would see an infallible source of protection for more suffering. But you'd first explore the qualities. You'd read some books on the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, so that your refuge becomes really a rich, deep, not just a superficial experience. The refuge sustains you, and it says it's the sacred door through which the teachings are entered. So it's a very powerful door that you're walking through with the refuge. So we would take refuge, but the reason that we're doing it, and here it's like you get a lot of merit through listening to the Dharma, but the reason that we're doing it is so that I can become a Buddha. Why do I want to become a Buddha, which is a fully awakened being? It's because then you're unlimited in helping all other beings with that mind state that is omniscient, that is free of all fears, that has the highest expression of wisdom, compassion, loving kindness, all the good qualities. So it's a nice little prayer. It really contains a lot of things. So let's recite. We'll recite it twice in the English, and then we'll chant it once in the phonetics. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Oh, Sangye Chodan Soki Chonam La Chan Chubadu Dagni Kyab Suchi Gi Dining Gi Peso Nam Gi Trola Pencher Sangye Drupar Zhong. Thank you. So just as a little structure today, I changed things slightly. This session will go till 12:30. There will be a break in this session, and then there will be an hour and a half lunch break, and then we'll be back from 2 to 4, like that. And if we need a break in that session, we'll take one as well.
Okay.
And then there's a puja after that, and because today is one of our tog days, like that, so you can join if you'd like to stay for that. So I'm just curious this morning, those of you that were here last night, how was this morning for you? Did anybody do some exercises? If you forgot, it's helpful to know. Explore, yes, so please. Any experience from...
I did the gratitude exercise, and I felt a lot better in the morning. And
great.
I usually hate mornings.
What's that? And you...
I usually hate mornings.
Okay, great. Wonderful. Fantastic. So we had an experience of gratitude waking up in bed, and the next moment... So you didn't think about death this morning?
Yeah.
Right. Most people don't really think about it till they turn 50. Okay, then they start thinking about it a lot. It's amazing. It's interesting. So other experiences. Anybody get to their practice? Yeah.
I did that practice you suggested yesterday, as well as remembering, thinking that what kind of attitude
is. I did the practice you recommended last night with the gratitude, and then I thought, if today was my last day, how would I want? And I thought about how the day would go and what I'm doing today and how I might be more kind or be a better listener or let somebody go in front of me like you suggested. So we'll see how that works out.
How did it work so far?
So far, it's good.
Pretty good.
It's early.
Right. Okay. So I've got Lori now on my team, okay? So... And what's nice is we have habits, I'm just picking on you right now, we have habits of, we're not kind to ourselves. We're not kind to ourselves, okay? So self-compassion is really important. It's a really important part of the practice. And so what I hear a little bit with Lori, and you're doing great, is I hear like, I'm going to mess up. I always mess up, So she's like, it's early, and you might be making jokes as well, which I think you are, but a lot of people, you set yourself up of, I can't do this. I hear that all the time, I can't do it. So Rinpoche, sometimes he's given us some exercises, projects at centers, and some of you are aware of Rinpoche's projects. They're vast and huge, and I've heard people say there was some stupa project really quickly when I was in California. In 10 days, Rinpoche wanted this stupa made, a small one, made for a past director of Vajrapani who had just died. And he asked three people there to do it, and they're looking at Rinpoche like, in 10 days, like, I could just see their minds just completely shutting down, like, because we tend to not push ourselves too hard with that kind of stuff. We push ourselves hard with other stuff. And then one of them made the very bold statement to Rinpoche, what if we can't complete it in 10 days? And Rinpoche just looked at me and said, the thought does not exist. Okay? So you have a choice to have thoughts like that exist or not exist. And they did it in 10 days. It was so... Again, be careful of your language and what you set yourself up for. Of like, oh, I got it going really well this morning, but I'm sure it won't go very well the rest of the day. You know, it's why? And so be positive. You want to be positive about yourself. Not just superficially positive, but I can do this. So if you notice that you have many habits in your mind of negativity, low self-esteem issues, which I had in my mind a long time ago, many... It's, you know, I just started to become aware of them. The beginning was just the awareness of it, of watching like, oh, look at that story I just got going about myself. Okay? And then I'd look at the story a little more closely. Is the story true? Is that story accurate? Parts of it are accurate and valid, but that's not all of it. So I started readjusting. Like really finding the truth and the parts that weren't true, I started dropping that. You know, that's not really true. I don't really need to keep. So, and the other thing that you have to do, and I've talked about this before in here, is please give equal airtime at least equal airtime to your positive qualities. to your positive qualities. How many of you do that? Right? Got three hands up. So it's interesting. And there's something about our culture that, now you're not being an egomaniac. It's not like I wake up every morning and this morning I was having breakfast with Karen and David. You know, I don't come down and be like, hi, I'm so great. You're aware of that, right? It's inside. It's in your mind that you, so when I do the gratitude in the morning myself in bed, and I first have that I'm in this body, and then I'm like, I have so many fortunate circumstances about my life. So many fortunate circumstances. And I'm not that different than any of you. You know, meaning I woke up in a safe, comfortable bed with a nice temperature in the room, and I knew there was food in the house, and I had decent clothes to wear. My mind is still thinking relatively clearly. My body's functioning pretty okay. That's 6-7 things right there. I have a loving family. I have wonderful friends. I've had access to a decent education. Like, okay, that took 20 seconds, right? For me to just, 10 things, circumstances of my life, very powerful, okay? But I don't stop there. I take another 20 seconds, my good qualities. You know, I have many good qualities. I'm not being an egomaniac. I'm just, and why? Because I know my limitations and I know my mistakes and faults and my weaknesses. I'm really aware of those. But I've been way aware of those for too long, too heavily. So, and I have some good qualities. And I have a little review of some of those. Just a very balanced mindset. So it's from there I am motivating. It's from there I am directing my awareness, and this situation that is so glorious in many ways is passing away really quickly. Soon I'm going to be gone. So I really want to make the most meaning of this time, this life, what I've got, and how can I do that? In my tradition, I'd like to become fully awake, a Buddha, so I can benefit all living beings. That really lights me up in many ways, and then I get out of bed. So just make sure there's equal airtime, that you're here. You're great. Doing great. Smiling and practicing, and what's the problem? I don't see any problem really like that. And we will mess up because we're humans. So Buddha nature perfect. Human nature not perfect. Okay? So we're flawed, and I'm not laying a trip on you. I'm just being honest. I know my flaws. I know that I'm limited. So when I do mess up, which will happen, I, you know, lay there on the ground. I pick myself back up. Try to see what happened. If I need to apologize to someone, I'll apologize. No problem. And try to learn from the message, and I keep moving forward. Now I have new information. Don't want to do it like that again. That didn't work. No. So that's our practice, right? Anybody else? How did it go this morning? Hang on one sec, because the microphone's right back there.
I just wanted to add that the practices become a habit, and they become automatic. Upon opening your eyes, your mind just automatically goes there, you know.
Yes.
You know, giving thanks for another day of precious human life. And then, as you said, the gratitude and that practice. But it does become a habit, and it will be automatic, that your mind just automatically goes. So,
thank you. That's right. That's what we're trying to get to. Thank you very much. That's the whole purpose, is you just do it again, you do it again, you do it again. So, and again, the process of adding it. So for me, I do wake up in the morning, it's the first thing, it just starts happening. That's what we're trying to get to. It just starts happening, the positive, you know, the practice right there. Okay. And then what we're trying to do with the death process is more and more introducing things into your life, so that if you get scared, you have a near accident, where's your mind? Where's your mind? We have to work with it. We have to work with it, but it does become a habit. Absolutely, that's what we're trying to do. So meditation, as many of you know, the word in Tibetan is gom, G-O-M, gom. It doesn't actually mean meditation. It means familiarize or habituate. So meditation's a form of habituating and familiarizing yourself with virtuous mind states, positive mind states. Yes?
I just wanted to say that I watched the opening of the Olympics last night. I watched the opening of the Olympics, and it almost brought me to tears where they had the dove and all the different children comprising the dove, children from Korea. It was just very powerful for me, very positive. I don't know if anybody else saw that.
Great. So how's your practice? No, were you here last night?
No.
Okay. So we were doing an exercise last night, waking up with some gratitude and then trying to be aware of that we could die at any moment. We're saying that's the easiest death meditation. This could be my last day. Not letting it cripple you, letting it motivate a practice. And so that is nice. If you see something that really moves you, peaceful, wonderful, can you find a way to bring it into the practice?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah. Great.
I'm very grateful to see that. I was very encouraged about a world which I'm not always very encouraged about.
Right. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that Sunday morning, tomorrow morning, like that. Yes.
So last night when I left, I wasn't sure if I was going to be here today. But I still wanted to do the practice. I still wanted to wake up in the morning and say, oh, this might be my last day. So when I got home, I felt really tired. I mean, I didn't do anything out of the ordinary during the day, but I just felt really, really tired. And I just went to sleep and slept. I don't know, like I lifted, something lifted away from me. So I just slept and very profound, soothing sleep. So when I woke up, I was like, yeah, I'm probably not going to be, because of the circumstances of the day. And I recall, oh, this might be my last day. Okay, so I was really sleepy. I mean, like my body wanted to just sleep, but my girls woke me up, and I was like, oh, no. Okay, so this is my last day. This is how we're going to roll. We're going to have a wonderful day, and I made pancakes, and I was playing with them. And I told my husband, wow, I have to go. Like, it's imperative that I practice. So he was like, no, but I just came here to stay. And I was like, no, I'm going to go. I'll take the girls. The girls can stay with me. You can rest, and I'll go. And I thought there was going to be like mayhem, you know, something like that. But no, it was just the intention, and everything ran very smoothly. Like I didn't have any problem, nothing. But I just felt that I needed to practice, and I don't know, it was really smooth, and everything just happened like that. So it doesn't happen, you know, I have to struggle a little bit, but this today, it didn't. So I was like, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting, too, and just the guy back there, he had his hand up for a long time, is the, what's also interesting is you had some other things today you were planning to do, which may have prevented you from coming. So that's what I don't know if I'll be able to get to the class because I have some other things on my agenda. You don't know if you get to the class because you may die first, but we never consider that. We consider, so it is interesting, you plan a holiday, and that's okay to be practical, to plan stuff. You know, you have to go to work, and you're planning when this event will happen or this event, or you get tickets for something. No problem, any of that. But often more and more I have in my mind of, you know, I wonder if I will be doing that. You know, I'm leading this pilgrimage I mentioned in October to Nepal, and there is a thing in the itinerary that says that if I cannot make it, there will be a replacement leader because I don't know. And my father could die. That would prevent me from going. I could die. And I think of it. I make prayers every day that may everything be well and I'll be able to go and lead the entire pilgrimage and it'll be great and safe and happy for people and that nobody will die. And, you know, because you just don't know what comes first. And they even say that is, you know, there's some famous teachings from the Buddha and things of don't even be attached to your next breath, and you don't know what will come first, is your next breath or your next life. Sometimes, you know, so it's kind of just playing with that a little bit in your mind, certainly the next couple of days, to see how, what's your relationship with death and impermanence. And so please, yes.
Let's see. Not sure where to start with this. Okay, I woke up this morning rejoicing that I took that first breath after realizing I was awake. And my wife said, we've got these two trips, we have to make plans, and something always goes wrong. And those two things that went wrong were big event, so I couldn't go to my sister's wedding, and big event, my father passed away when her nephew was getting married. And now we've got, anyway, and now we have a big event for her father out in Arizona and a big event for my niece up in Indiana. And just that, it was fear that something was going to happen, maybe a death in the family, because that's what happened before, almost, one time. I'll just stop right there. It was just scary. You know, just thinking about all this stuff was very scary to me.
Right. But you had one death that interrupted one event. The other event was interrupted because of?
It was an accident that it just, I couldn't be in my sister's wedding. And
due to an accident.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So you had a couple unfortunate things due to. So, I mean, this happens.
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry. It's, so the other thing is, you know, at least you have some awareness around it, and maybe you choose to get refundable tickets.
Right.
Seriously.
Right, and that's when my wife, again, she said, well, I already put trip insurance on the trip out to Arizona because my father could pass away before this big birthday party could happen for him.
So, I mean, I think that's wise to do that. I think it's wise to do that, and they give you these options of travel insurance, and the people that go on this pilgrimage have to have travel insurance, medical evacuation insurance, that, you know, just... Things do happen, but if you have, you know, there are tendencies. Some people are, you know, my dear nephew who's living with me right now, who's a wonderful guy in his 20s, he's a great guy. He's a very sensitive, bright person and interesting person. And he just, you know, has his habits of binge drinking with his friends, but the bad stuff happens to him, not the friends. He's the one that falls down the steps and breaks his elbow, shattered his elbow. He's the one that got beat up in a field, you know, blah, 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 from, you know, and he lives in England, and but now he's living with me for a bit. So, you know, so I, at one point I was saying, and my sister was very worried, his mom, and saying, you know, you talk to him, like he listens to you or you. But what happens is I finally, the second time, because he has permanent damage now, he'll have lifelong to his elbow, and he's going into a second surgery in April on it, and it'll be okay. It's working. It's going to be okay. But it's a hassle for him. And he's aware. And he goes, and he said to me, I have this lifelong thing. So I talked with him and said, here's the deal. Like, you just need to be more careful and aware of that. You know, and you have people in your life like this where the bad stuff happens to them. And we just have to be a little bit more aware. But it does keep the death thing more heightened sometimes for somebody like you than other people. Nothing happens, and then suddenly there is a sudden death, and they're flattened. You know, they never thought about it. So just keep using it in your practice when you can, and get your travel insurance, I'm afraid to say. But that is the reality. It's really hard. But I finally sat down and seemed to communicate with my nephew about, I mentioned a friend in my community when I was in my 20s, and all the stuff happened to him. Okay? He woke up. This was, you know how 20-year-olds, they get drunk and they're hanging out and they start one-upping their stories? Well, let me tell you what happened to me. This kind of thing. We're sitting around one night, like 15 of us, and then this guy suddenly popped. Everybody had their stories, but then he said he woke up on a slab in the D.C. morgue, toe-tagged, with a tag on his toe, under a sheet at the Washington, D.C. morgue. Not in a drawer, on a table. And I heard that and I thought, okay, you win, Tony. You know, that's like, they found him in the street, you know, no clothes from the waist up, and they couldn't get a pulse, and But the clerk said that that happens to people. And he, you know, and he, people do wake up, and he had him on a thing, and then he sat up. And so, so I mentioned, I just mentioned to my nephew, and I said, you know, if you're that guy, you need to, you just need to be more careful. And the karma changes. The karma can change. And then you're not that guy anymore. You're not the person that has the bad things. And it would be neat when you get through your first thing, the event, and nothing happens. There's very high likelihood that you'll get there. And then you're kind of like, okay, I broke it once. And so when I went to Laudo, you can go and look out on this little pilgrimage thing. I can tell you more about it if you'd like later. The first few times I went up there, I've been up there many, many times to do retreat. And the first few times I went up, you have to fly, 45-minute little plane ride up. And I never made it up the first time, and it's a hassle. You get up at 5 a.m., you go to the airport, you wait 7 hours till the, you know, because then the clouds come in until they say, sorry, no flights today. You go back to your guest house, kind of, you know, and you wait for them to call you again. And then you wait, and maybe you go the next day and the third day. And sometimes I had to wait 4 times, go to the airport, wait to get up. And so it was always, I just felt jinxed. I won't ever be able to do it. And then I one time went with a friend. I brought her up. And I said to her, I have to tell you, I never get up on the first time. So we'll go back to the guest house. And we told the guest house people, we'll probably see you later. And then we went up. And I, you know, it's like she was like my lucky charm. But then I've made, you know, so all of a sudden it broke that. So it's possible. That's good to think about like that. Okay. Thank you very much. He's got his info, so he's leaving now. Okay. No, I'm joking. I'm teasing you. Okay. So we did a meditation last night on impermanence and death. On impermanence. Nice to, again, just to review, to think about gross impermanence, subtle impermanence. Gross is like where you see changing things happening very quickly, changing, and then there's subtle impermanence. And we can see the way our mind operates. You know, there's gross changes going on that I can track, and then there's subtle things making up moments of consciousness. And so we're aware from this that everything changes, that everything changes. So the more you get into a sense of the changing nature of my body on a gross and subtle level, my mind on a gross and subtle level, my external reality on a gross and subtle level is changing, you start to realize everything's changing. So death is, again, part of the change. It's a natural thing that goes on in life. It's a natural course of your life. And so you can over and over kind of soak your mind in that this is just a natural unrolling of what happens. Why resist it more and more? Why deny it? Why put it, you know, not wanting to talk about it? And that was a lot of the way I grew up in the 60s. It was not discussed. It was not okay, really, until Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in the 60s came out with her book. I think the book was On Death and Dying. And she kind of broke it open for people to start discussing a topic that was so taboo. Nobody would discuss and things. I mentioned this in previous classes. I was 13 years old. We went to visit my great aunt, who was dying of liver cancer. An hour away, we drove with my mom, my sister and brother. My mom was really clear to say goodbye to her. We knew she only had a few weeks left, and she was home with her daughter, and we weren't allowed to say anything, to talk with her about it, to actually say goodbye. And her daughter came to the door to inform us, we're not telling her. Like, my aunt was upstairs, we're not telling her that she has cancer. You're not going to, like, she doesn't know. You know, but my aunt had shielded her from all the doctor's visits, of any information. And, like, you think my aunt didn't know that she was dying? And we show up, and it's all this facade. And so that's the way it was in the 60s, my experience of it. Kids did not go to funerals. They sometimes didn't get to say goodbye to parents that died, and it was all very hush-hush and kind of drawn shades and things like that. So fortunately, with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and then it moved out into this hospice movement, taking care of people, palliative care, making people comfortable, talking about it. And now it's a huge field, and we're actually encouraged to kind of be open and honest about death. We will talk about there is humor in death. There is incredible poignancy and moments of things, and I will get to talking about organ donation, euthanasia, suicide. We'll talk about all those things like that. And I'll make time, there'll be some time for questions. So I want to go over more, first moving into the traditional Tibetan Buddhist approach of death and what they say about death and the 9-point death meditation. And I even remember that at Land of Medicine Buddha, which is a sister center in California, near Santa Cruz, California. And I lived out there for a long time at another center, Vajrapani Institute. But at Land of Medicine Buddha, they started our first hospice that I'm aware of in the States. And I believe it's still there, Tara Home, it's called. There's one bed, I believe. And a friend of mine was the first person that died there. She became a nun near the end of her life. She died of cancer. And when she was dying, actively dying, we were having teams of people go over to spend time with her, as you do with hospice care, and people doing practices with her, which I'd been doing for months with her. But in the very last couple weeks, she was in and out of sleeping and in and out of clarity to some degree. And I was there with one of my friends, a bit older than me, who'd done a lot of hospice work. And my friend woke up and she was very confused and kind of tormented of what was going on, and she was in a bed but she couldn't move because she didn't have any strength. And so she was kind of agitated in and out, and we went to the bedside and she woke up and she looked at us. And we said, "Is there anything we can do? Are you thirsty? Do you want this?" We tried to speak slowly and directly. And she looked at us in distress and said, what's happening? What's going on? I'm weak. I can't lift my head. I can't get out of bed. What's going on? What's happening to me? And so then my friend next to me leaned into her and said, and we've been doing all kinds of work with her, and she said, very quietly, she said, "You're dying." So, I mean, it was like just a point of context to remind her. And like normally people don't want to say that, but we're Buddhists. We were, she's a nun. We could practice. And she said, remember, you have cancer and you're dying. This is what you're doing now. And then she just needed the context. And she said, oh. And she was like, oh, right. Oh, okay. Thanks. Got it. She didn't say thanks, but you could see this kind of relax come over, like, oh, that's right, she's in her dying process, and that's why she can't move. So it kind of, you're not expected to be moving when you're actively dying sometimes at that point. So there wasn't any pressure, you need to get up and do something, especially people that are doers. So sometimes you just need to get somebody back in the level, we're here, if you need anything, we're here, So it sounds kind of raw to some experience, but it was helpful like that, helpful for her. So let me talk about traditionally.
Mr. Jonathan Landau's wife, I think she runs the Tara Home.
Is she running it now?
I think last time he told me that his wife runs the Tara Home in California.
Oh, does she? I don't know. I don't know that. They're dear friends of mine, but I'm not sure if she's running it, or there was somebody else running it at one point, but I'm not sure. Yeah. This was a long time ago when it started that other people were involved, and wonderful woman named Lenny, who's out there. She's in her 80s now, and she was the main person that got it going. She was a nurse and really fantastic. But maybe Truce is running. I'm not sure if she is, but maybe. So the disadvantages, and I want to talk about traditionally, there's 6 disadvantages to not recalling death and 6 advantages for recalling death. Okay? And we just look at these. And these are get you helpful because a lot of people, and also with death, I wouldn't go marching off to your non-Dharma families and be like, okay, we need to talk about death at dinner right now. You want to find, be sane about it. You want to find appropriate times to talk to people, especially if you're having the conversations with your elderly parents or someone you know is actively dying so that they can get their papers together and what they would like, what kind of support they'd like. But you have to find appropriate times to have those conversations. It's helpful. You don't just march it out there in the middle of some happy wedding and suddenly I only talk about death. That's the only meaningful thing. So let's be practical about it. For a Buddhist, let's look at the six disadvantages. If you don't think about death, and it's really helpful on a daily basis, honestly, you know, you will get used to thinking about it. It motivates my practice. I do not find it morbid in my life. It's not a morbid thing. It can be sometimes sobering. So if you're distracted and your mind's flying around in your practice, if you do not want to practice and you're lazy, okay, think about death. That can get you on the cushion. They say it's something that brings the mind down. So if you find you're very over-elated, you know, sometimes we have times you're on a really good track in your life and everything's going great, right? Well, I rejoice, honestly. I wish that was for everyone, but we're going great and we forget when it's not going great and what it's like. And then we forget about other people where, and then some superficial things come out where somebody comes to you and says, you know, my son is flunking out of school, or we're having money problems, or my husband just got this illness, and you're kind of like, oh, but you're not really there with them, because you forget when it was like that for you. So death can kind of bring you that perspective. Like, everything may be going really well for me right now, and I could die any moment right now. I want to make sure I've got that open-hearted experience, kindness towards myself and others. If you don't think about death, these are the six disadvantages. You will not think of the Dharma. You will not remember the Dharma.
The advantages or disadvantages?
Disadvantages. You will not remember Dharma or your Dharma practice. Right? And you see in your own life. You don't think, you go, yeah, I got time. Right? Okay. Number two. If you do remember Dharma, your Dharma practice, you won't practice. How many of you put it off? I know so many people. When my daughter enters college, once I get the new job, once I deal with the stuff with my dad's house and the car, and then I'm going to practice. You don't know if death comes first. You missed all that chance to just consistently have a little something moving along with you. And maybe it's more than a little something eventually. Okay? So number three, if you do decide to practice, you won't practice properly. And even if you do sometimes practice properly, you won't practice seriously, meaning building a rich, consistent practice. The fifth is you may continue to court negativity in your mind and act vulgarly, as is a word vulgar is used in Liberation of the Palm of Your Hand, creating more negativities. And the sixth is the worst. You will die with regrets. Die with regrets. And for those of you that were not here last night, if you're interested, I gave some exercises you could do. I'm also teaching this, I mentioned, with the Discovering Buddhism module for our New York group. So we're going over some weeks, and I gave them these exercises. And the first is, please write down your bucket list. And a bucket list means all the things you would like to do before you die. It could be you want to travel to this country. You want to do a retreat. You want to do your Vajrasattva retreat. You want to get a master's degree. You want to get married. You want to have a kid. You want to live in California. You want to, you know, whatever it is. You want to buy a boat. That bucket list. But there's a second part of the bucket list is, what qualities would you like to develop in yourself or enhance in yourself? And what qualities would you like to lessen in yourself? Negative qualities you might want to lessen. Diminish. So that helps you die without regrets. You're kind of moving in that direction all the time. So it's helpful to write them down. You may go back over 10 years of a bucket list and it may change. That's okay. It's okay.
Can you please repeat the fifth one?
The fifth one is, you will act negatively. You will court a lot of negativities in your mind. They say vulgarly in Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand. You're rude. like that. And I noticed myself, and there's all these different things that delusion comes from in your mind. And I know my mind well enough, and so I was in the New York subway a few weeks ago, and they're doing a lot of work in the New York subway, and they do it at night when less people travel, obviously. So I finished teaching the class at 9. I got down. People were asking me some questions at the end, and I didn't get down to the subway till 9:35. Usually it's not a problem, okay? But one of the criticisms of the New York subway is they're not posting signs to tell you when they're going to start the work and when. So 9:30, that subway line closed that I needed to get back to where I was staying. And there was tape across the turnstile thing. And I'm like, okay, so here, number one, change came. Change. How's my mind deal change? I was okay with that. I was like, huh, okay. And I went, and there was a guy in the booth. And they're very nice, honestly, the guys in the booth. So I went over. He was very helpful. And he said, there's one more A train. I wanted the A train, okay? He goes, there's another A train. Okay. He goes, just don't go, this turns out, just go for free into the thing. Okay, he opened the gate for me. Down I go, downstairs. Well, there's people down there on the platform. I didn't know they were the workers that were down there, but I didn't know. And I see some people, and there's some people that didn't look like workers. And then one guy said to me, there's no more trains. So I said, well, the guy in the booth. So this went on back and forth. I went up, I went down, I went up, I went down. The guy said there's a train, and the guy's like, you know, they said there's another 9:48, there's a train. You know, anyway, back and forth, up and down. And everybody was really nice, and I was fine. But for some reason, this tall, young guy kind of attached himself to me that was waiting for a train. I don't know what, I thought he was on drugs, honestly. He was kind of really, really hyper, right? And he was yelling. He was cursing, and he just suddenly thought that he was with me. I don't know why, okay? But, you know, it's cold, I got my, you know, and he's like over my shoulder. And so when I went back up to the guy in the booth and said, you know, the guys downstairs are saying there's no more trains. Are you sure that, you know, he's right here? And he starts screaming and cursing at the guy in the window. You know, and I'm like, excuse me, you know, and I said, excuse me, please, let me, and then but he kept ignoring me, and he kept just screaming and cursing, and I couldn't hear, and I go down, and I go, and it's up and down, and he's with me, this guy, and it was making me, so here's the next level. I'm nervous now. I'm afraid. You know, I don't know what's going on with this guy, and people have weapons, I don't, you know, so I'm a little bit on alert, but there's people there, but all he has to do is pull out a gun, and I'm, you know, what are you going to do? So I didn't know what was. And he's like in my face, and I kept trying to, I said, could you please, you know, I'm over here, I'm whatever train you want to get, great. You know, I'm trying to, but he's just totally obliterating me and up and down, up and down. So finally we go down, he's right here, and there's an announcement comes on. So I want to hear the announcement, okay? And I can't hear because he starts screaming again at the announcement, to which then I turned. Okay, so I got scared, okay? And then irritation sprang out of the, because he was irritating me. So here comes irritation that's part of my fear, but my mindfulness dropped. So I wasn't thinking about my death. I mean, a little bit, it was there, like he might attack me, but it was more I lost my mindfulness of thinking, if I am going to die, how do I want to be? I'd like to be kind. All that happening right there, the fear, motivating anger, to which I turned to him, right, and said, please shut up. You know, I mean, at least I've got the please out, but the shut up wasn't something I would have wanted to say, okay? But I also was kind of weighing, because he wasn't listening to anything else I said. And it just, I blurted it out. All of a sudden I went, please shut up. I'm trying to hear I was trying to get a little more forceful with him, but then he turned and he said, are you telling me to shut up? Like all of a sudden, like I'm like, oh my God, like, you know. So it's just interesting watching your mind. If I had had a pattern, even with fear, could I get good at controlling my mind, which I'm not that great with fear? Could I get to see? So I was just watching the whole thing unfold. And then hysterically, a train came by. It was not the A, it was the E. Okay, train came by. The E was going nowhere, though. The E was going like World Trade Center, nowhere I needed to go. It was going nowhere. The E came by, there were people at the doors open, and he jumps on, and he looks at me, and he says, it's our train. Like, he's so, Let's go. It's our train. Come on. It was bizarre. And I just looked at him and I smiled and it's like, and then the door shut and he maybe left my life forever. Let's hope. I, you know, don't know what was going on, but I was just playing with the mindfulness. I remember sitting there, standing on the platform thinking that was really not a very beneficial response for a Buddhist nun. Like if I could just find a better way. And I was just there with myself in the discomfort. I didn't have to fix it. I wasn't laying a trip on myself. I was like, got a little scared. I had to figure out how to get back because there were no more trains. That was it. And I had to come up back upstairs and figure it out. So it was all this stuff. And by this time it was like 10 at night. And so just being with yourself, if you can automatically continue to practice with your mind so that whatever's happening, my eyes are open and I'm noticing fear arising. But I'm noticing it. And that might make me immediately there. That might make me right there be more vigilant. And I wasn't more vigilant. Like, the mindfulness, boop, went out the window. And suddenly I'm like in like a survival mode. Okay, get this guy away from me. Are there any more trains? How am I going to get home? There's no, you know, what am I going to do? And so just to keep patterning is just watch fear arise and watch how it motivates irritation, which turns into anger. Because I know my mind. This is how my mind works. That's what's usually under the anger, some kind of fear. So now that means I have to be more vigilant. More vigilant with my mind. I've got the wild horse is starting to rear up, and I'm going to grab the reins a little bit more tightly. This is how we practice. Yes?
So what else could you have done?
At that point, she just said, what else could you have done? At that point, I'm not really sure. I mean, I don't think it was the worst response because I was really trying to get him, you know.
I mean, you were mindful of your own death there. You're trying to, you know, not.
Yeah, I mean, what I might have done was said, please quiet down.
I don't think please was working with that guy.
Right. Yeah, maybe it could have been, you know. And it's funny because I got home to my friend that night where I stayed, and I walked in. He goes, oh, how was the class? Or how did, he didn't get to the class. And I said, I just told somebody to shut up. So I'm not sure it's going that well. You know, it was really, but we had a laugh because on some level, yeah, it wasn't the worst thing I could have done. You know, I mean, I wasn't screaming the F word at him and, you know, really, really creating, you know. But it is also something to notice today in this day and age with the divisiveness we experience sometimes on the planet, which we're going to talk about tomorrow morning, is not escalating something. So the shut up did push a button for him. Now, fortunately, it didn't do anything worse where I backed off. And I think he must have looked at me and thought, like, who is this? What am I talking to? You know, there I am in my maroon parka with my, you know, my wool hat on, and he must have thought, what is this? Some kind of maroon snowman in front of me. You know, I don't know. So,
but I see you as being like Venerable Rubina says, when you use anger in order to like help someone else, like it's a good use of anger.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you were trying to help the guy in terms of helping yourself.
Yeah, or you could call it wrath in that case. They say wrath might be a more gauging, is it beneficial? And there are times if a young child is running into the street with traffic coming, what I would do is I would very strongly yank them back and be like, that is not okay. Like, absolutely. You have to make an impression. So we know when to use wrath at times when it can be beneficial.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. You're being a little hard on yourself.
Yeah, no, not so hard. I mean, I was afterwards. I was like, okay, you know, the guy's gone, but you just know, you notice little things of could I have said something in a different way? Could I, you know, just gauge it like that? Yeah, and watching what was arising in the mind—that's always interesting. Once you start watching your mind, it can be a fascinating journey. You're never bored again, really. Because, no, really, you might be waiting, you know, in a doctor's office and you just see all the stuff that's going through your mind. You know, somebody walks in, sits down across from you, and suddenly all the judgments, you know, the computers kind of, you know, they're fat, they're thin, they're this, they're that. I wonder if they have cancer. I wonder if they're, you know, I wonder the different, you know, you just start watching. It's fascinating. Like that. And the more control we can get over it, the better, obviously, through becoming aware. So disadvantages, you will not remember death. Disadvantages of not thinking about death. Will not remember Dharma. If you remember, you won't practice. If you practice, you won't practice properly. If you practice properly, you won't practice seriously, which is about consistency. You will act vulgarly. You will die with regrets. Those are the six disadvantages of not remembering death. There's six advantages of recalling death. It's one of the most beneficial things you can do as far as balancing your mind. Very, very beneficial to inform all of your activities of that day as much as possible. And again, it's not that I woke up this morning thinking this could be my last day, so I'm not going to go to work today. It's not about that. You engage practically, but if I have a thought in the morning, this could be my last day, what I'm interested in is how am I going to be today? What is my attitude today if it's my last day? And hopefully we would like our attitudes to be kinder, more gentle with ourselves and others. Maybe there's humor. Maybe I have much more of an experience of trying to help others. Maybe I do Tonglen meditation. So all the beings on the planet dying and suffering and with illness, could I take that on, all their fear, all their anxiety, and let it chip away at my self-cherishing here? And then as that is decreased, the self-cherishing, I have much more space, happiness in my mind. Let me offer all of that, all the goodness to them. Taking and giving. Very powerful place to die in that mindset. Most beneficial. The second one is it's most powerful to recall death. It motivates your practice, gets you on the cushion. 3, 4, and 5 are related. So they say it's one of the advantages and it's beneficial to recall death in the beginning, in the middle, and in the end. Those are three of the points. In the beginning, the middle, and the end, which relates to the beginning of your life and the beginning of your practice, the middle of your life and practice, the end of your life and practice. The beginning of your life and practice, it motivates you to get on a cushion to start something. I better get started. Death is going to come, and I'm not sure where my mind will be at that time. And also in the beginning of your life, because you can make more positive imprints, not to put stuff off till later. And then in the middle of your life, a lot of people are building careers and raising children and paying mortgages and developing their buying property, houses, things like that, and developing their careers. So it would certainly help all of those activities, put those activities in perspective like that. And in the middle of your practice, recalling death is what sustains a long-term practice. So some of you have been at this for several years, and I could tell you that 20 years into the practice, for me, things got kind of dry, boring, you know, the things. So it's good to change up your practice a little. You may have daily commitments that you do for the rest of your life, okay? But you can always insert certain prayers and different things. And the Gold Prayer Book has a whole variety of different prayers. And the FPMT website has a whole vast amount, you know, and you slowly learn them. And your center hosts this fantastic Light of the Path retreat. So the next one is scheduled for May 2019, about 3.5 weeks. And thank you to Donna, who has been so extraordinary with organizing that, and all the people here that have helped. It's unbelievable. So I think this is the sixth year. So I've been at all of them, and you are about the closest to it. You're 4 hours away. Don't miss it. Please don't miss it. It's the easiest thing for you to get yourself to. I know it costs money. I know you have to work. Go for a week then. Just go for 1 week. Go for a weekend. Go for 2 weekends. You can do it, but I would not miss it. You sit with this great master, and we have a retreat prayer book. So it sets you up for practice. People say, what do I do? There it is. There's some things you read. There's some things you learn a lot from older students. People are leading sessions. Some of it won't make sense to you. You learn. It was the same when I started. I started with a retreat like that, and I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. and you learn, and they teach you. This is one way of practicing, and like that. And each time it's a little different. So please try to get to that. It's one of the most extraordinary things. It's right in your backyard. Can't miss it like that. So this is what sustains the middle of your practice, the middle of your life. You try to get to a special program now and then, a special teacher you like, you saw them online, you want to, and you get yourself in person. It's different in person, right? And it can really kind of change some things up and give you that, you know, I've had that. And sometimes I was at centers, I was very isolated from communities when I was in Vermont. So once or twice a year, I made sure I'd find something. This teacher was coming to New York. I go down. It was just the thing I needed, just to liven it up. So be wise that way. At the end of your life, it's certainly helpful. It's the only thing that will really be there for you is your Dharma practice. So at the end of your practice, the end of your life. The sixth advantage is you will die with no regrets. That's a nice feeling. Wait, hang on 1 second. So, this is from Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, and then I'll take a question for a sec. Khyabji Pabongka Rinpoche wrote Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand. It's one of our Bibles, so to speak. It's a great detailed Lamrim text, Lamrim being stages of the path, our philosophy. And he says, take the essence and derive value from your precious human rebirth. Take the essence and derive value. Are you doing that now? How would you like to do that? And that relates to your bucket list. And sorry, just to go on 1 minute, I mentioned the bucket list last night. Here's the second exercise I gave. There were three exercises. These you can do for your life. Don't just say, I only have the weekend. The second exercise was to plan your memorial service or funeral. You can be very specific, make it very simple, whatever you'd like. Whether it's music, who you want there, what you want them to read, what you want people to know. Excuse me. Third exercise you could do is getting your papers together, your legal documents, last will and testament, and living will. Do you have power of attorney? Who's going to make medical decisions for you? We're going to talk about that tomorrow afternoon. More practical applications. What do we do? So taking the essence and deriving value, to go back to that for a moment, is the precious human rebirth we're familiar with at the beginning of the Lamrim. Are you aware of what makes up a precious human rebirth? What are the things that would constitute a precious human rebirth?
You meet Dharma.
You meet the Dharma, but what are the main conditions, the headings it's under? What makes up a precious human rebirth? Thank you. Leisures and endowments, okay? So there's eight freedoms, or leisures, eight situations you're free from, and there's 10 endowments. 10 situations you have, 5 are environmental and 5 are personal. What are some of those situations? What are you free from? Precious human rebirth.
Money.
Free from?
Material objects and money.
Well, we have that as humans. So I don't know if we're free from that, actually. But that's a good point to bring up. What are the situations we're free from?
The instinctive need to kill, to feed ourselves.
Instinctive need to kill, and I'm going to call that being free from being born in an animal realm. Okay? So we've got 3 lower realms of existence. We're human. There's 3 lower realms of existence. Hungry, there's a hell realms, Buddhism has hell realms. Hungry ghost realm, and an animal realm. The animal realm we can interact with. We see it. We're free from those situations. If you'd like, I can go more into that, but we'll go on for a little bit right now.
I'd like for you to go into that more.
Okay, great. And also, let me just, you had a...
Oh, just what was number 5?
Number 5 is, it's in the end of your life, it's important to think about Dharma. So you've got 3, 4, and 5 are beginning, middle, and it's important in the beginning, mm-hmm. important in the middle, and important in the end. That's 3, 4, and 5 of the advantages to thinking about death. So the advantages are, it's most beneficial, Number one. Number two, most powerful, based on how it motivates the practice. Number three is it's advantageous in the beginning of your life and practice. It's advantageous in the middle of your life and practice is four. Number five is it's advantageous in the end of your life and your practice. And six is you die with no regrets. Thank you. The hell realms, this is what makes us afraid of dying, is the hell realms and the lower realms. Buddhism has hell realms. They are temporary. Not like Catholic hell realms where you go there for all time. They're temporary. What gets you into hell realms, particularly the worst ones, we have a variety of hell realms though. We don't just leave you burning to death. We have a whole variety you can pick and choose from. We have freezing cold hell realms. I don't mean to make light of them, okay? And they say they are actually places that do exist. What gets you into some of the worst hell realms, and think about your mind, would be sadistic killing, right? It's a terrible state of mind. Sadistic killing. Okay? You take great glee in torturing and killing beings. Okay? So think about that mind. That mind alone is like a hell realm, isn't it? So you can see how it relates and gets you born in a situation. You're creating a cause. What are you creating the causes for? That's what we have to think about in life. What am I creating a cause for right now? You know, if you're feeling bright, somewhat optimistic, you're giving it your best shot. Good. That's a great, you know, you're moving along. Kind of positive mind state, trying my best, noticing when I make mistakes, and it's the best we can do. But really that negative mind state gets you born in hell realms. They are, some of them are burning hot hells. They're, as you would imagine, hell realms, incredibly torturous places. We're free from that as a human. Not experiencing that. The next realm up is called hungry, ghost, or in Sanskrit, preta. Preta. And we'll take a break in about 15 minutes or so. A preta realm. Hungry ghost or craving spirit is caused by, and think about people that are hungry, thirsty, you know people grasping. They got this, it's not enough. I need more. I want more. I want another. You know, we know people like that in the human realm. This would be more of that degree, more suffering, much greater. And they describe these beings with swollen bellies and very skinny necks. The food doesn't fit down. If it does go down, it burns their throat all the way down. So they're starving, grasping. Their limbs spark, little rail limbs. They've got very thin limbs. And they spend their entire lives looking for one little dirty piece of food to eat. And that's all they have the karma to connect with, because that's their mind, grasping, like that. So for instance, if I held up a clear glass of water, this is the difference of our minds, okay? A hungry ghost, which has the karma to see this, filled with pus and blood. That's the nature of their minds, which causes them to experience that, okay? As a human, I hold this up as a clear thing of spring water. Okay, everybody seeing that? Okay. As a god, someone in the god realm, upper, higher realm, they would see ambrosial nectar. Okay, so we're going to get to the god realm in a moment. But, so think about what I am creating the cause to see. And this is interesting because we all have a different perspective. So we have different karmic seeds in our consciousness. And that's why if I held up a tomato, right? How many of you like tomatoes? Okay? You guys would go, oh, tomato. How many people here don't like tomatoes? Okay? So you hold it up and you go, you know. It's not the tomato side. It's my mind side, what my mind projects onto something at any time. And that's why some of you see people and you go, oh, he's so nice. I really like him. And here comes somebody from over here. Oh, he's such a jerk, that guy. Okay. It's just from the mind side. It all comes from your mind. So they would create intense grasping and things like that could create you to take rebirth in a hungry ghost realm. The next realm up is the animal realm. This is a realm we interact with. We interact with the animal realm. Now the interesting thing about the hungry ghost realm, We as humans don't see them normally, but they can hear Dharma. They can hear Dharma teachings. Animals can hear Dharma teachings, but they don't understand them, for the most part. Hungry ghosts can understand it, makes imprints for them to eventually, once they exhaust the karma, the causes that got them into the hungry ghost realm, then you move out to a less suffering realm. That's how it works in Tibetan Buddhism. These are teachings from the Buddha. This is what Tibetan Buddhism says. Animal realm is also a lower realm of existence, plagued by ignorance, laziness, and all the other things, suffering that animals experience. Now, if we have pets, that is the peak of the animal realm. It's the very top of the pyramid. Okay, so a lot of our pets don't seem to be suffering. And they have very good lives, and they're well taken care of with plenty of food and safety and things like that. But I've also noticed with pets I have lived with, there's a deep lack of understanding, ignorance. So a pot falls off the stove, and the cat, like, tears out of the room, doesn't understand it's a pot fell off the stove. It's like, you know, I've seen animals tremendously scared. Your dog may be cowering under the bed when lightning comes, lightning storms. They don't understand. They're safe, but they're completely upset, animal realm. But most animals live in the sea, and if you really check up on the animal realm, and you can watch your pet as well, but think about the vast part of the animal realm. It's consumed with hunting to eat, so you're killing other animals, or you spend your whole day eating, like an elephant is a vegetarian, but it just spends its entire day eating, right? Not so focused on others like that. You are fighting with other animals, maybe killing other animals, getting killed by other animals, going to the bathroom, sleeping, and making more animals. That's the animal realm, pretty much. So you really have to investigate, please. Investigate what I'm saying. Don't just accept it. Check up. Is this really... So we are free, as human beings, from those three realms, and we are free from an upper realm, the God realm. Now, the God realm, when I came into Buddhism, I thought that was where I wanted to go. That sounded pretty good. It's a hedonistic realm. You have every perfect pleasure, but you're not enlightened. And what happens is you use up much, much positive energy and merit, and usually after the God realm, you end up taking a lower rebirth. And the God realms, there's so much pleasure, you have no incentive to practice Dharma. That's the problem with the God realm. So the human realm is the optimum realm to get enlightened from. Why? You have leisure that afforded you the time to come here today. Right? And then you have suffering in your realm that gives you this incentive of there's got to be an end to the suffering. I don't want to suffer anymore, but I also see people around me. I don't want them to suffer anymore. So yeah. That motivates you. Understand? Are we communicating? Mm-hmm. Okay. So let me take questions in a little bit. And then we've got other things we're free. So if you really want to explore a precious human rebirth, it's very helpful in the Lam Rim to go detailed through the different things. Certain endowments you have, the 10 endowments. A Buddha existed. Shakyamuni Buddha lived 2,600 years ago and taught the Dharma. He not only existed, he taught you how he got there. And he taught Tantra. So there will be Buddhas that manifest. There's a Maitreya Buddha. I know you have a statue somewhere here. It's a Buddha that's sitting European fashion, you know, on a throne, like with legs down, the way we sit in chairs. And when Maitreya Buddha will come, he's the next one. When he comes, which will be in like countless eons in the future, that's probably a time when we're really comfortable sitting cross-legged, right? But he doesn't teach Tantra. Maitreya means loving kindness, but he doesn't teach the quickest path to enlightenment. So right now, you have it all. Buddha came, taught, teach, the whole path is there. There's places like this that further the Dharma. It's another advantage you have. Maybe some of you have faith in the Dharma. That's a personal endowment that you have. There's monks and nuns that are trying to live the path to further. That's another endowment, environmental endowment. So all of these kind of things. We live in what's called, what they might call a central country, a central land. And all they mean is it's a land you can practice Dharma. Because in Saudi Arabia, it's illegal. It's illegal. Can you imagine? So it's like that. There wouldn't be any Dharma centers. You know, I wouldn't be living like this, looking like this in the country. There's countries on earth like that right now where it's illegal to practice like that. So we have every perfect advantage. So again, from Pabongka Rinpoche, take the essence and derive value from your precious human rebirth. And they're very powerful part of the Lam Rim to read the parts of the precious human rebirth, because it's a direct antidote to depression and anxiety. It's a very powerful antidote to depression and anxiety. You know, appreciate what you've got. Like, we don't spend enough time. And we're a lot of us are, it's a culture of whiners, right? Rah, rah, rah. We have it so good. We have it so good. So it's really helpful. So you can a little bit make adjustments, make realistic adjustments. You know, you don't have to be a nun, right? But look at realistic adjustments. Can I, like I talked to Lori, asked a question last night, was, so what if you start, you get 5 minutes going in the morning and night? Little 5 minute practice, a little looking at women. And then I see that's kind of nice. So the next month I might have eked out 10 minutes in the morning. That you can do, 10 minutes at night. You find another time of the day. You got some free. Then maybe I have a day off and I might spend an hour kind of reading this thing, reflecting on that. Oh, I printed out this meditation from Discovering Buddhism. I'm just going to do that for a couple weeks. Do something repeatedly for a couple weeks. The reason is it goes in more deeply. Then move on to another thing. But and after 2 weeks, you won't even need the paper. You'll just know, oh, yeah, I kind of got that now. Give your mind a little exercise in it. It takes 2 weeks to make a new habit, generally. So give yourself a couple weeks. You can change it up. Try another meditation the next week for a couple weeks. 2 weeks later. So imagine you got 52 weeks a year, 25 different meditations. It's quite powerful like that. Maybe you don't do 25. Maybe you do 10. Maybe you do 5. But that's very powerful in 1 year. You know, and there's guidelines through the Lam Rim, and there's guidelines. FPMT has very, you can see this course, and here's the meditations for the course, and this course, and they teach all of them here. It's fantastic. Come to some of the classes. Very helpful. So what's interesting is, you know, we also have natural disasters, catastrophes like that, hurricanes. There was one that came through last year. We were at Light of the Path, the big hurricane. We got the end of it. And you get these forewarnings that the storm is coming, and you get preparation. You start making preparation for that. Well, the storm is coming, you guys. Death is coming. There should be like a marquee. Remember in the old days, the movie theaters? You know? Coming to a body near you. Death. It should, because it's coming. It's the one thing you can count on. These other things, we're not sure. Sometimes the hurricane, even the hurricane, then it changed course. It went over here. Looked like it was a direct hit. No. Then it went over here. So this is how, you know, people, so we definitely want to look at what's our lives, what's our minds, can I make some realistic little adjustments, borrowing 15 minutes from this meaningless activity that I do every week, every day, can I start moving some of that time over here? You can do it. Talk to other people in here, make a buddy in here, so that you're like, what are you going to do? I'm going to let go of that one TV show. That night, on whatever night, that half hour show, it's just a habit, I don't need to do it. I could certainly do something in that half an hour. Could read that book, or, is it possible? Can you do that? A little bit, try to commit like that. Question.
Thank you. Back to the realm, sorry. You said humans can interact with this realm, the animal realm, but animals can't understand and practice Dharma. But as humans, can we still put imprints
yes.
on their mind? Okay,
yes,
I just
definitely.
Wanted to make sure I understood that correctly.
So if you say mantras to your animals, you can play. People have these looping little radio things that play mantras or something and leave it all day next to where the cat sleeps. Fantastic. I know when animals were dying, you know, people would put prayer wheels on their head, take them around the stupa. You have a stupa here. Bring your sick animal, if it's dying, around, put it in a box, bring it around, carry it around the stupa. Bring your dog now on the leash, healthy dog. I had a cat. One of my cats used to follow me around the stupa at Vajrapani. She didn't know what she was doing. But I would walk and she would run after me, and I purposely do it, you know, so she'd run after me. And I'm like, some imprint. And there's some significant stories of, there was a moat around a stupa in ancient days, and some cow pooped in the moat, in the water. So there's caca in the thing, and a fly landed on it, went around the stupa. It was a monk in his next life due to the that cause. You never know. Possible, right?
I have a question.
Yes.
I'm a psychiatric nurse, and I work with some of the people that you mentioned that are in the realm in which they do have pleasurable feelings from hurting other people.
Yep, yep.
And that's one of the questions I struggle with is, are these people mentally ill? Certainly they're mentally ill at some level. I don't struggle with that. But as somebody who believes in reincarnation and listening to what you were just saying, could you explain to me a little bit fully what they're experiencing?
Yes, so a good question. I used to think that the other realms were a state of mind, and there have been some teachers that actually said they are places that they live, you know. And however, sometimes there's a crossover, and you see somebody in a psychiatric institution. I've seen this. And I was going through to visit a student, and there was a guy on the edge of his bed. The temperature in the room was like 75, and he was wrapped in heavy blankets, freezing to death. His teeth were chattering. His lips were blue. He was, you know. So for me, it was like a cold hell that he was living in, but he was in my realm. I saw him, and so I don't know. I just think the mind does get stuck in a place where, due to imprints, so we're very much in our tradition, cause and effect, due to karma. Cause, you're making imprints in the consciousness, and they are going to ripen in one way or another unless you purify them first. And you can purify anything, okay? So don't get too upset with yourself. You can purify anything. Doesn't mean we're going to do negative things, because we can purify. So, but for some reason, whatever got caused, they're having a manifestation in a human realm, human body, but some torturous state that looks like a cold hell realm. I couldn't say what their internal experience is other than what you witness outside and say, he must be freezing to death. But the... Yes, they can. And the other thing is, Tibetan tradition talks about spirits. Now, not everybody believes in spirits. But some of the mental illness, they say, is that a spirit has attached themselves to the person. Again, a cause was there for that to happen, and it makes you crazy. So there are lamas I know that do exorcisms. It's not common, but the only experience I had is I was at Kopan Monastery. My first course, the woman next to me had what we might call in psychiatric terms a psychic break, and she basically had a breakdown, you know, to some degree, but it was manifesting in, it was bizarre. It was like The Exorcist. I mean, except her head did not turn around. But she had this primordial ooze coming out over her head that stunk, which they say spirits come with that kind of stuff. Like it's a sign of the spirit that a lama came, met with her, and talked to the spirit and said he could see the spirit. The spirit followed her from her country attached to a little old penknife that she had in her luggage. Why? The cause was there in her mind. The cause was there. People start meditating en masse together. And some people's minds, it opens something up and like that. So I'm not saying meditation's a bad thing. You need good guidance and good support, and you do it with a good mind. So they did this exorcisms, and I mean, it was affecting her body in a way. Like, and I'll give you an example. She was in a sleeping bag. You know, when you're in a sleeping bag, they're kind of narrow, can't quite move. So I heard this from two people in her room, two different women independently. She's in the bag, and she was flipping inside the sleeping bag, her body, like this. Okay, and they're not exaggerating. These women, I mean, this is, so they turn the light on, they're like, what's happened? And she had this stuff coming down over her head, and then she had light blue eyes. And I got to be friendly with her the first few days till she had this break. Then when the next time I saw her, because we were doing these watches with her, and then the embassy, you know, doctor from her embassy came up and took her, and her parents flew over. She ended up, she was fine in the end. And she, so then I saw her, and when it was my shift to wait in her room with her and help, because we didn't want her to harm herself, my experience was her eyes were black. So again, with psychiatric care, you're like, well, her pupils are dilated, which happens with mental breakdowns and psychic breaks. And there was always a reason. For me, I could explain it away, because I didn't believe in anything at that point. I wasn't Buddhist. I wasn't buying any of this spirit stuff. But when I heard these independent stories from the roommates, I have to say I was like, well, maybe, you know, who knows? What? And then they did an exorcism, the lamas. They said they rid the spirit of her. Her eyes were light blue again. It was bizarre. She said she felt something enter her navel, and then her eyes would be black again, and she'd be crazy. I don't know. I had no explanation. I had no explanation. However, if I go back 3 years before that, I was working in Washington, D.C., and my neighbor across the street, when I lived in Pennsylvania, a woman a year younger than me, so she was 24, 25 years old, she went into our mall and shot and killed 3 people. And I got the news in D.C., and then she was on the front page of this paper, black and white photo. She had light eyes, I think, and her eyes were black. So was it a spirit possession? They said she was paranoid schizophrenic. She had been treated for that for some years before, that they said was triggered by taking drugs, taking the wrong kind of drugs and stuff. So I don't know. And this lama was brought some years later to visit some students, and there was a student in a mental institution in Germany, and they brought him through a ward, and he looked through the ward. He only spoke Tibetan, but he just pointed out in the ward which ones were spirit possessions of crazy people. So could you, if you rid the spirit from these people, which some of the lamas have done, would they be fine? The lamas say, yeah, they would, if they have the karma to have the spirit rid of them. You know, if they have the interest to go to a lama to say like that. My brother-in-law was ill for 11 years mentally, and he lived in New York, and he wasn't a Buddhist. So I asked Rinpoche about, could I do something for him? And he said, if you want, you could take him to this lama in New York, and he would do this practice for him. And I mentioned to my brother-in-law, but he didn't want to go like that. And he died from his mental illness like that. But many years ago. But so you don't know. It's all cause and effect and what's in our minds and what we're open to. And just like you know now, some of you, I know people that get cancer. And I know people that opted for chemotherapy. Some wanted surgery, radiation. Some took herbs. Some didn't want any chemo. Some, you know, you all have choices. Some changed doctors and said, I want this person. Some are doing a combination, and they wanted acupuncture with massage, and everybody has their own ways they want to be treated. So you can't help everybody, but you can present information, and I don't know if that's helpful.
That was very helpful, thank you, because it's something I'm struggling with, because as you, years ago, I'm 61 now, and years ago it was like, I got a mental illness, I mean.
Yep.
And now I'm like, does that really make sense? Because some of the people I work with, I've never seen black eyes, but they have this distinct look out of their eyes.
And, yep.
So I don't know. Anyway, I'm done.
Yeah, because there is a look sometimes, and again, I don't know for sure, but I'm posing. What happens is you can't go back into your psychiatric institution and your work and talk about spirits, because it just, you can't, because people, you know, it's just not. But if there's a Buddhist student in a mental institution at some point, that has been posed, and lamas have come, and they've gotten fixed and cured, and if they're open to it, if the family is willing, and it's interesting, but there is a look I've noticed. So when I saw this woman at Copan, I immediately thought of Sylvia, because it was the same. I was just like, it's Sylvia. And then I, in my mind, I was like, I wonder if she was taken over by a spirit possession of something, of whatever happened. You know, you could point to clinical things and say, well, she took that drug, and then that was this, and then she was abused by her grandfather, blah, you know, whatever the story. But she's in prison for the rest of her life, Sylvia, in western Pennsylvania, unfortunately. She's a very bright woman, and she's now probably 57, I think, 57 years old, and she went in when she was about 25. Yeah. Yeah. Kim. And then we're going to take a short break.
I just wanted to add to the discussion that I think there's a lot of prejudice around mental illness in our culture and fear. And so regardless of what's happening with that being, which we are really not privy to know because we do not have clairvoyance, I think one of the important things is how we treat this individual with kindness and compassion. What is our mind vis-a-vis this person? Because that's what we have control over. And to be unafraid to show that in a public way so that other people can see that model.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. There's a lot of stigma about mental illness, and it's really hard. And also for the family supporting people mentally ill, it's really brutal for them. And I think that's really true. And it is. And also the thing with spirits, some of you might be going, whoa, what is she talking about? You know, but that's how I was in the beginning. I didn't believe any of this stuff. But slowly, just in checking, not that I've seen spirits, but just kind of investigating the parts of the Dharma that made sense to me, that I really liked. I went into that first, and then I went, well, now I'm going to revisit this area, like reincarnation I didn't believe in the beginning. And so slowly you can move along like that. But we don't need to focus so much on the spirits and things. But it's interesting to hear about that.
Are we doing more questions?
No, we're going to take a break. So we're going to take a 15-minute break. Okay? Now, in the break, we're not blah-blahing. We're not wasting our blah-blah energy. You can either choose to be silent in the break, okay, or please discuss with other people about what are you doing to prepare for your death? What kind of adjustments could you make? You can actually get to meet somebody. Introduce yourself to somebody you don't know if you'd like. I know it's a little bit revealing. This is the way we make a new friend. Is there something realistic you could do that you're going to adjust possible? Because you might help the other person get some ideas as well. Okay? Thank you.
Venerable, over here. If I could make that announcement I was talking to you about. Hi.
Charge of the wonderful library here. Thank you so much.
Sure. I just wanted to let you all know that we have a death and dying section in the library with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's book and Buddhist things on how to die, how to help someone else along their process, quite a wide variety, including books by His Holiness. So it's the bottom shelves of the library over there. Enjoy.
So you're not going to mention the book I co-authored? Okay. So, sorry, if anyone's interested... If anyone's interested... part of your intro course is Buddhism in a Nutshell. There is a book called Buddhism in a Nutshell that I co-authored with Rinpoche and Lama Yeshe. It was a course the organization, thank you, Donna, asked me to record. So the book, the written part is very different.
Thank you.
Than the recording here, an audio CD. So this is an overview of the Lam Rim. This recording, it takes you through the whole thing. It's 11 hours. Corresponds to this online course and this book, and it's a nice course, and you can also now download, I think, the audio for an MP3, and it's an e-book as well. So I just wanted to mention Buddhism in a Nutshell. It's very helpful. It's a great stocking stuffer for when you want to give this to somebody that's like, what about Buddhism? What, you know, they may be interested in that, and I think they managed not to cut out too many of my jokes on the audio. So... that's one thing. And the other thing is with death and dying books, and thank you, Liz, for mentioning the library, which is great to have a librarian, a center this thriving. So of the death and dying materials, and I must remember, if you're interested, I could email Donna. I have a reading list. Now, it doesn't have all the books on it because there's so many, but I kind of, over the years, just listed a whole bunch of death and dying books from traditionally Tibetan to practical books that are very helpful for people. And I could email that. It's like a page or something. And it includes things. Things I would recommend are, I mean, the books by Rinpoche and things, Traditional and Wonderful, and there is one with Rinpoche and Sangye Kadro, who, Venerable Sangye Kadro, our longest term nun. She's American. She's the author of How to Meditate. So this book is called Wholesome Fear. And that's a lot of how I think about the death thing. It's wholesome fear. It's not paralyzing fear. Right? When you think about death, it's like, makes me a little antsy, a little nervous, but it's for me to organize my life in a meaningful way. And then the other thing would be, there's more practical books. So there's a book if you're interested in losing, somebody near you lost a life partner. You're trying to help. I found really helpful Joan Didion, The Year of Magical Thinking. Fantastic book of her losing her husband after 40 years. Really well done book. And then there's a newer book out called Being Mortal that's a new one that's come out. There's always things that are evolving that are coming out, newer things that I found helpful, a lot of different books like that. So I want to talk about the 9-point death meditation. This, again, is more traditional Tibetan approach, the 9-point death meditation. This is how we like to meditate, another type of meditation on death, as opposed to, this is my last day. Okay? So there are three main headings for this, and they're called three roots. Under each root are three reasonings. And the reasonings are designed to lead you to three resolutions that will hopefully invigorate your practice. The three roots are: death is certain. The second is the time of death is uncertain. The third is the only thing that benefits you at the death time is your Dharma practice or spiritual practice. Under death is certain are three reasonings. Number one, everybody dies. Number two, every moment you're closer to death. Number three, the time you have to practice is very little. And these lead you to a resolution: I must practice Dharma. I must practice Dharma. The second root is the time of death is uncertain. This is harder for us to realize. Most everybody in this room intellectually has it. You're going to die. I think most of you get it. Especially the older you get it much more that it's coming. But the time of death is uncertain. Many of us even use our language. When I'm old, I hear people say. Do you know that you'll live to be old? Okay, so I actually change my language now. I'll say, well, if I live to be old, like that. So three reasonings under this, okay? Number one, people die at every different age. Number two, there are many more things supporting your death than really keeping you alive. Number three is the body is very fragile, very delicate. And these lead to a resolution: I must practice Dharma now. The emphasis on now. Because I don't know when I will die. The third root is only Dharma can benefit me at the death time. This is the easiest part to, I think, have a realization of. Only Dharma can benefit at the death time. Number one, wealth and possessions are of no help. Number two, friends and family are of no help. So we're going to discuss these because I know these push people's buttons, you know. Number three, even your own body is of no help. This leads to a conclusion. I must practice Dharma well, with the emphasis on well. So not only will I practice, not only will I practice now, I will practice well. I will build a rich, consistent practice. So let's look at some of these. Death is certain. I think most of us intellectually have it. Okay, we have it here. We don't have it here. Here is when you have an experiential realization. I am going to die. You know, you really get it. And then your life starts to change, and you start creating changes in your life to support that I definitely know I'm going to die, and I better get myself ready. Okay, you have it here. So what happens is the two types of meditation we teach in this tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, one is called shine or calm abiding. Shine or calm abiding. You're placing your mind on an object or a topic of the philosophy, and you're letting it abide there, stay there concentratedly. That's mostly what people think of when they think of meditation. I'm focusing on something unwaveringly, boom, I'm there. Shine, okay? Second type of meditation we do is analytical meditation. We're analyzing something, okay? We often use it with the philosophy, the Lam Rim. So if you're in the death is certain, okay, let me analyze. We're going to do this in a moment. Everybody dies. Everybody dies. Well, I know everybody dies, but so let me think about, you know, all the most powerful people on the planet. They could make nuclear war on the planet, but they can't stop death from happening to them. Right? The geniuses on the planet, Einstein, he died. He couldn't figure out a way out of it, but I think I'm going to figure out a way out of it. Okay, but he didn't. The most creative beings on the planet, Mozart died, Beethoven died, John Lennon died. Right? They didn't sort it. Spiritual people died. Jesus. Great leaders. Gandhi died. The Buddha died. Even the Buddha died. So you come with analytical meditation, you come from every angle. Scriptural references. Something you heard in a class. Life experience. Something you read. Another. You come from every angle, and suddenly the intellectual understanding, I am going to die, starts moving to an experiential realization. And then you know, I'm going to die. And when you get that little juicy aha moment, if we do it in the meditation, then you take your concentration, your shine, focus on that experience to deepen it. So initially the way we meditate on the Lam Rim, analytically, on our philosophy, you're forcing realizations, meaning you're doing it again and again and again. And I'm like, I know I'm going to die. I'm going to die. I am going to die. Focus on that. I concentrate on that. I am definitely going to die. You know, we did a week-long retreat with a great lama many years ago in California, Reber Rinpoche. Reber Rinpoche, amazing lama. And there was Venerable Rene, this wonderful monk, was leading the meditations. And the way you effectively meditate on the Lam Rim, you are doing the same session sometimes over and over and over. And Westerners hate it. We like variety. I already meditated on that. Why do I have to do it again? It's boring. Okay? But what happens is it does something in the mind over and over. My own experiences where it, and suddenly it went deeper and deeper and deeper, and I'm like, I am going to die. So there was a period, and Rinpoche had him going over these sessions, you know, and basically he was leading, like, just think. I am definitely going to die, you know, over and over and over, but then with some references. So some people got a little depressed in the middle of the retreat. It's normal. It's actually a good sign. But when you come out the other end, often, hopefully, you're more invigorated. I'm going to practice. I'm all inspired. Okay. And it happens often with retreat, which is why we like to do retreat. It reminds us and helps us position the mind in a more beneficial setting. And I give an example, Light of the Path. How many of you were at some part of Light of the Path anytime? Yeah, fantastic, wonderful. Thank you. Right? When you came home, the first day you came home, the first night you got home, first day, were you all inspired? I know what I'm doing now. The first, great. It's like that. And then sometimes it just fades. And I know people have said to me disappointedly 2 months later, I'm not doing the practice. That's why we go back into retreat. Then you reinvigorate and you reposition and you try again. And then our minds suffer from delusion, so it slips off, and suddenly Netflix is really important, and the football game is important, and I've got to do this, and we have life responsibilities, too. We have to find balance. That. So you understand? So that's how we combine analytical meditation with shine, how we use both to bring about, first, a contrived experience, meaning you're a little bit forcing by over and over putting your mind in the place, putting your mind in that place, of whatever topic, but then it becomes uncontrived. Automatically a realization arises, and you know you're going to die, or you know you have a precious human rebirth, and you get that appreciation every moment that you're living. You don't waste time. You understand? We communicating? Okay. Isn't it great? We have the air conditioning on in February. Amazing. Finally it warmed up. Oh my goodness. It was so cold up north, and you was cold down here, right? It was so cold up there, it wouldn't stop. I mean, you get 2 to 3 days, it's cold. Okay. 2 weeks went on. Then we had a couple of days it got warmer. Then it went down again. So I was leading a retreat for the New York Center in, it was for anybody, Nungne, in the Catskills in mid-January. It was a beautiful, beautiful place. Beautiful place, and it was a great, we had a great time, 3-day weekend, Martin Luther King weekend, a great time to do Nungne, it's a 3-day weekend. Hopefully we can do one here in the future. Donna's tried to talk to me about it, and so we went to this place, and the temperature dropped again, and one night it was minus 13 wind chill, and we were all in separate buildings to the main building. So at night you just walk 5 or 10 minutes to the building, but the 10-minute walk, with my glove in front of my face to breathe, and it was very, very cold, and we were in silence, and I arrived at the door of the studio we were using for the Gompa, and everybody was bundled up with parkas, with the hoods and the scarves and their hats and everything, but because it was cold, because the sky had cleared, and that's when it's colder, so the stars were just. And so I caught the stars, but nobody wanted to look up because it was so cold. You know, you're like, come in. So I remember I got to the door, and there were two women behind me, and I went, like, don't miss it, because by the end of the session it'll be light and you won't see the stars. And I pointed, and they're just like, yeah, we got it. Like, open the door. You know, it was so funny. It was so cute. Okay, so let's look at death is certain. In fact, we'll do a meditation right now. It'll be easier to explore this route and its reasonings. Just sit comfortably. You can lightly close your eyes. Perfectly fine to sit in a chair to meditate. Just have your feet straight down so the body's balanced. You can always put a cushion under your feet. And if possible, try not to lean too heavily against the back of the chair, and your back over time will become stronger. And as we also lay a foundation of our practice, we don't just pop into meditation. Slowly allow the body to relax into a good position, as comfortable as possible. And in your own practice, please experiment with different cushions when you're home. Allow a normal, natural breath to move through your system. And as you briefly scan your body right now, notice any places you're holding tension and allow your breath to open up some space, letting the tension go. And let's look at the posture of our mind right now. And just reflect. We have every perfect situation and circumstance right now to practice. Just think, I have every perfect opportunity to practice. I'm a human being with a relatively sound body and mind. I've met the Dharma at a time when a Buddha appeared. Buddha taught. Teachings are furthered and benefacted. There are centers like Kadampa Center, books easily accessible. Teachings all over the internet. A great scholar who lives here, Geshe Gelek. Every perfect opportunity. Just breathe in for a moment that wave of appreciation. Really appreciate. And as this situation is rapidly passing away, let's just reestablish a positive motivation, directing your awareness in a most beneficial way. Just set your motivation again. So just think, everybody dies. Everybody dies. Can you think of anyone who has escaped death? There's certainly people who go into remission from cancer. Will they live forever? Who is the oldest person you know or have heard about? And just think. Think to yourself, I am definitely going to die. I am definitely going to die. There is no power in the universe that can stop death from coming to me. Just reflect on that deeply. There's no power in the universe that can stop death from coming to me. Let's reflect a little bit more on this. Men have stepped on the moon, which is pretty extraordinary. But they die. The smartest people on the planet have not figured out a way around death, like Einstein. The most powerful people on the planet, they have not sorted it. And think about great spiritual leaders. Jesus, Mother Teresa, Pope John Paul II, all of them died. The Buddha died. If the Buddha could not figure out a way out of death, just reflect, how is it that I am immune from this situation? And just think, I am definitely going to die. Everybody dies. And I am definitely going to die. So if at any time in the meditation you feel a deeper experience of your death, place your concentration on that experience to deepen it. And when it fades, go back and analyze again. So let's look at another reasoning under death is certain. Every moment, my death is moving closer and closer. Every moment I am closer to death. We are now another Saturday closer to death. Just think, I am another morning closer to death. Another weekend closer. You may be another cup of coffee or cup of tea closer to death. Another Buddhist class closer to death. Another drive to the center closer. Notice your breathing. Here, another inhalation closer. Another exhalation closer. Another breath closer. Just explore that for a moment. So birth is as if we were dropped out of an airplane without a parachute. When we hit the ground at the bottom, that is our death. So life is this falling moment by moment by moment by moment. Just imagine that. The ground is inevitable that it will come. And there's no way to stop it. Just think, I am definitely going to die. So the third reasoning under death is certain is it's definitely coming because there's very little time to practice Dharma. We have very little time to practice Dharma. Think of your 24-hour day, your normal life. If we remove 7 to 8 hours for sleeping, got 2/3 of the day left. So 1/3 of your life is spent sleeping on average. Just review all the activities of your day. How much time do you spend practicing Dharma formally? How much time is spent making beneficial imprints in your mind that will benefit you at the death time and for future lives? How much time do you spend countering delusions as they arise in your mind? Applying an antidote as a delusion arises in your mind.
So just think, I am definitely going to die. I am definitely going to die. If you find fear arising, depression, a sinking of the mind, can you make a resolution, a determination from these three reasonings? I must practice. I will do it. I must practice. I've got this. I must practice. Just generate as much as you can, if you like, that determination in your mind. And please relax and slowly open your eyes. Any questions? Is everybody okay? Doesn't look like anyone has died yet from this meditation.
So, when I do the meditation, I see the seems like the space peer open. It has a hole. It has a black pupil light from the hole. So I hesitated, should I go inside or not go inside? And then automatically the Sancha or Mummy Baby Hong has come out. And then the light changed to white light, bright white light. And then I get more relaxed. Yeah, so I wonder, what's that?
You wonder?
What's that?
What is that?
Yeah.
Well, it's, some of it is beneficial, and some of it I would call distraction. So the meaning is, if we're doing an analytical meditation, because you're trying to train your mind, it's better to stay on the topic. As far as an analytical meditation, more formally on the death process, like I was leading, because it can lead you really into a deeper experience. However, when we meditate, many things get opened up, and it's okay to explore. And if we're leading more of a white light meditation, where I'm trying to purify or I'm trying to bring love into my mind, it would be more focused on something like that. So if you find you're in an analytical meditation, or something else, and then the mind suddenly white light up, is again, I might try to bring my mind back, or you can feel free to explore, and if it's pleasant and nice, no problem. It's not really a meditation on death, but that's okay as well. But that would be more for me if you're leading like a compassion meditation, and I have an image of the Buddha of compassion in front of me, white light might be coming, or other colored light, doesn't have to be white, and I might be reciting Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, and letting the light come into me. That would be more that kind of meditation. It can be very pleasant, and it can open up yourself to grow more compassion in your heart and mind, like that.
this is more of a just a comment. I'm analytical by nature, so your analogy of birth as being thrown out of an airplane and the ground being inevitable really hit home for me. I had the thought of the Dharma being a parachute. I asked myself, if I'm thrown out of this airplane, am I going to have a rock tied around my neck, or would I rather have a parachute? That was a tremendous analogy for me, and that's a tremendous meditation that has a lot of meaning for me. Thank you for that.
Great, you're welcome. It's really helped me, that one. I can't remember where it came from or when I thought it's really helped me. It's there's certain meditations you do that occasionally that visual feeling can get you, and for me the parachute is certainly the Dharma, can be the Dharma, and also there's a safety net for some of us, right? What's a safety net? Anybody have any ideas? For me, it's the guru. Safety net, you know. Like, you know, sometimes I think Rinpoche's down there like, I got you, you know. We don't believe it a lot. We don't believe it, but the Dharma, the guru, it's all the same. It's all the same, but the practice really can sustain you to have a soft landing. Softer landing. And it can be terrifying, the falling. You know, like you really get this thing. The other thing, some of you may have done some meditation on precious human rebirth. And so at one point, formally in the Lam Rim, after the 8 freedoms, 10 riches, as we just mentioned, it's very rare, they say. It's extremely rare to get yourself into the life you just got yourself into. It's very rare. But we go, really? Like, aren't I going to come around and do this again? Is it that rare? So what was interesting, one of the analogies they use is, how rare is it? And so to try to get you to understand how rare is, as some of you have heard the story of the blind sea turtle, right? Okay, so there's a blind sea turtle. You know how the seas of the world are vast? I think we're pretty clear about that. And there's a lifesaver, a yoke, you know, that floating randomly on the top of the seas, all over just floating, golden yoke, okay? The blind sea turtle only surfaces every 100 years to get air. What are the chances of it getting its head through the yoke? That's a precious human rebirth. Like, that's how rare. So I never got it. I'm like, oh. I read the blind sea. It never meant anything to me. But somehow I was in one retreat alone, and so I started with the vastness of the seas. Somehow I got into that. It's like the dropping from the airplane. Like, it was, that worked for me, the visual. And I was like, God, there's so much water all over the planet. And then there's this little lifesaver floating. And somehow really, it was helpful. So you come sometimes in different ways from meditations. You try different things. Sometimes different times in your practice, you pick up an old meditation you didn't like. And suddenly you must have purified something, and suddenly it works for you. And we're at different phases in life. So some people will say, I did this practice, and that really helped me. And we're all at different phases, so don't compare yourself to other people. It's you and your practice. You can get inspired by other people's practice, and we teach each other constantly. But everybody comes to things at different times that have meaning. So we are out of time. It's a lunch break like that. So I'd like to stop for lunch and do a lunch hour. And we're going to continue to talk about this, and we are going to pick up at 2 o'clock. So you have an exercise at lunch. Please don't just babble if you can. You're another bite closer to death. You're another eating a salad closer to death. Another conversation closer to death. Try to keep it all. You walk out of the room, you're another step. Another step. See if you can keep that heightened in your mind. Continue to reflect on, this could be my last lunch. This could be my last drive. You know, please don't have an accident and, you know, freak yourself. But, I mean, just keeping that awareness in a practical level, grounded, alive for you. Have you thought about those things? There was a student that came to our classes in California. Some people leave post-its around their house to remind them. And his, what he said, just for motivation, it wasn't about a death training, for motivation, on the dashboard of his car, he had a post-it that said death. And that worked for him. It helped him drive more compassionately. That worked for him. That was, so make it in your own words. What works for you? What speaks to you? And I'd like to dedicate what any positive energy we've created from this morning, thank you so much for coming and for your effort. I'd like to dedicate it to our being able to move along this path by understanding more about our death so we can invigorate a strong practice that will get us enlightened so we can benefit all living beings. I'd like to offer our food on page 207 in the Gold Prayer Book. We bless the food with three syllables, Om, Ah, Hung. And you can visualize the Om is at the forehead of all the images in the room, white Om, a red Ah, A-H, a blue Hung, just like the syllables, H-U-M. So white, red, blue nectar rays are coming into your food, wherever your food is now in the restaurant, whatever. Blessing the food with the body, speech, and mind of the holy beings. And then we'll recite this prayer. When it says guru, guru is spiritual teacher in Sanskrit, virtuous friend, spiritual teacher. Someone who all the qualities of a teacher, has more knowledge than you, teaches, you know, they love teaching, they have compassion, they have a somewhat subdued mind, they have some understanding of emptiness, there's all these qualities. What they're trying to lead you to is that inner voice of fully manifest wisdom, compassion, loving kindness in your own heart and mind. And sometimes they just manifest externally, like Lama Zopa Rinpoche or His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So guru is really that sense of Dharmakaya on one level, which is the truth body of the Buddhas. And it's really the wisdom that pervades everything, from which everything comes. So that's what we really mean by guru, ultimate guru. So we will make this food offering and also just take a moment to think about all the beings on the planet starving that do not have access to the beautiful food we have. And could we just imagine offering the food to all of them first? And it alleviates their suffering, bringing them to ultimate happiness. Food that is completely empty in nature. Imagine offering to all the holy beings symbolized in this room, and it brings great bliss to their holy minds. Om Ah Hung, Om Ah Hung, Om Ah Hung. Lama Sange Lama Chöde Jit Lama Gedun Te Kungi Jepo Lama Te Lama Nam La May the food nourish us so we may nourish all others. And so really for the purpose of getting enlightened, to benefit all living beings, we will practice the yoga of eating lunch. Please enjoy your lunch. And we will meet back at, let's say like 5 past 2, 10 past 2, to give everybody enough time. Does that sound okay? Thank you.